This week, VOA correspondents break down major news and developments in West Africa and why two of America's top diplomats, Janet Yellen and Linda Thomas-Greenfield, are visiting countries across Africa. Also,
that corruption factor is top priority when it comes to our choice of voting booth.
With just weeks to go until a landmark election in Africa's most populous nation, we'll look at what is at stake for Nigerians as they head to the polls on February 25th. Straight Talk Africa starts now.
Hello there and welcome to Straight Talk Africa, and we're going to get right into it. Let's begin our show with our reporters roundtable. And with me to break up major developments that we've seen happening on the African continent, particularly in West Africa, I'm joined here by our reporters Ignatius Anor and Idrissa Fell. Gentlemen, welcome to this show. Great to have you both back here on Straight Talk Africa again. Ignatius, just as we saw in the headlines there, I want to briefly talk about the U.S. sending its top diplomats to the African continent. We have U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen now in South Africa after visiting Senegal and Zambia. This week, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Linda Thomas-Greenfield travels to Ghana and Kenya. What's with all the flurry of diplomatic activity, and is what we're seeing the U.S. making that play for the continent like they said they would?
Thank you so much, Haiti, for having me. It's always a
Absolutely
treat to be
pleasure.
With you. So, like you said, let's go back to what happened at the U.S. Africa Leaders Summit in Washington that we covered. At the end of that summit, President Joe Biden said that real success is not in the announcement, it is in the follow-through. Mm-hmm. And so that's exactly what we're seeing. Yellen has been in Africa since last week. She started, as you rightly said, from Dakar, Senegal, met with women groups, met with African youth leaders, and also government officials. At that particular country, she spoke about trade and investment flows from the country, and then the United States as well. From there, she also went to Zambia. Now, Zambia is, as you know, one of the key producers of cobalt, on the African continent. It is also currently facing some serious issues with its debt restructuring, piled on by one of its biggest creditors, China. And so Yellen, on one hand, has been talking about how are we going to be able to help this country be able to restructure its debt, get its economy moving, and give its people the badly needed relief that they need. From then, she would also, as you said, be in South Africa, meet very soon with South African President Cyril Ramaphosa as Africa's most industrialized economy, to talk about issues of trade and investment flows again between both continents. So it's this administration essentially putting action behind its words, coming back from the U.S. Africa Leaders Forum. And senior government or administration officials have said that this is something that's going to be the new normal. It is a way to express their deepest commitment and what they call a 21st century partnership with the African continent. And that's why beginning today, we're going to see Thomas-Greenfield, who is the United States representative to the United Nations, also visit some key countries on the African continent, beginning with Ghana, with Kenya and Mozambique. With Kenya and Mozambique, those two countries have issues with insecurity and food insecurity. And as you know, the war on Ukraine has impacted, the food needs of the continent. There are also humanitarian issues that Greenfield is very passionate about. This is going to be her third trip to sub-Saharan Africa as she began serving in the role of the representative of the United Nations. So it's essentially a big deal for these two leaders. The senior government officials are saying there's going to be enhanced engagement within 2023 and then beyond. And actually, in the coming few weeks and months, we're going to see senior government or cabinet officials also going to the African continent to A, listen to their concerns and see how best the partnership can move on.
Wow, it is serious stuff very early on in the year. We'll see how all of that pans out this year. But I want to turn now, gentlemen, to the latest around Russia, the United States, and this notorious Wagner Group. Now, for people who don't know, the Wagner Group is a private military company, basically a network of mainly Russian mercenaries. They are believed to have close ties to Russia's President Vladimir Putin and have been involved in war zones around the world. Now, for years, the Russian government has denied any connection to the Wagner Group. group, but there is evidence, including from the United Nations first-hand accounts, that they have been used to pursue the Kremlin's interests from the Middle East and Africa to Ukraine. Now the United States is slapping new sanctions on the Wagner group and says it will designate the network as a, quote, transnational criminal organization. Idrissa, they have been active, as we just said, on the continent in wars in Mali, Central African Republic, Mozambique, and Libya. Just how big is the Wagner group's foothold on the continent, and how far does it go back?
You know how it works is a Wagner group, they say, let's say in Mali, they say they have only 400 guys there. In Central African Republic, they say they send 300 instructors. But we see that in Mali or in Central African Republic, since they come in 2021, I think, and maybe earlier for CAR, they took a lot of cities. You cannot take all those strategic cities in a few with 300 soldiers. So their numbers, people don't know how much they are. But in Central African Republic, they were very, very efficient. The three quarters of the country were held by rebel groups, and then they came and helped the country regain control of more strategic cities around CAR. In Mali, they are trying to do the same. They had been in Libya for a while, helping Marshal Khalifa Haftar to regain control of Sirte, which was under jihadist group, and even tried to recapture the capital, Tripoli. And people tend to forget that Wagner group was also in Khartoum during the protest, and they are very close to the general called Hemdeti, who is a major guy for doing repression in Sudan. And if you remember, Russia signed an agreement to open a huge port on the Red Sea, and the contract was for 25 years. So it means that these guys are here, and expect that they are fighting in the Cabo Delgado region where you have all those jihadists in Mozambique. Right. And what is amazing is in CAR, the Wagner group was working closely with the Rwandan army, and the Rwandan army is there because of the peacekeeping mission of the UN. Different from what happened in Mozambique, where Rwanda was called for help, but they joined those things. I don't know how deep is the relation. I cannot prove or say that if Rwanda has direct relation with the Wagner group, I cannot say that. But in those fields, they operate together.
Quite a shadowy group. And Ignatius, you wrote about this on voaafrica.com, and whether these U.S. sanctions will really bite for the mercenary group. We know the White House has issued a warning to those doing business or wanting to do business with the Wagner group. Let's take a listen here to John Kirby, the White House National Security Spokesperson, and what he said.
With these actions, and there will be more to come, our message to any company that is considering providing support to Wagner is simply this. Wagner is a criminal organization that is committing widespread atrocities and human rights abuses, and we will work relentlessly to identify, disrupt, expose, and target those who are assisting Wagner.
Ignatius, what are analysts telling you about the impact of these sanctions?
Well, yesterday I spoke to one analyst from Nairobi, Kenya, and then another analyst here in Washington. And the Kenyan analyst is Declan Garvin, who is with the risk consultancy firm WS Insight. He applauded the move by the U.S. Treasury to designate the group as a transnational criminal organization, but said that it should have been something that was done either a year or many years ago. We've seen that they've made inroads as far as the war in Ukraine is concerned. And he says that this is something that would essentially disrupt the supply chain for them because they are using some modern technology. And that's why they've even taken credit for the kind of inroads that have been made in eastern Ukraine, for example, like drones or like talkie-walkies that they're using to get intelligence from the camp of the Ukrainian forces. And what the analysts are saying is that what the sanction does is that it kind of looks at how they are getting these equipment, making them advance in the war and disrupts that supply. The other analyst, who is Michael Shurkin from Atlantic Council, actually said, well, usually sanctions never really have any impact, but it is necessary because it goes again to say, particularly for countries in Africa that you're seeing, and as Idrissa was saying, that we have the Wagner Group in some parts of Africa, like Sudan, like Mali, and northern Cabo Delgado in Mozambique, that what it does is that we're telling these African states, if you are doing business with these countries, you're going to be at the wrong side of the United States, and that's not something that you want to do, especially looking at, how bad the situation is in Ukraine and how that is affecting African folks.
Gentlemen, I really wanted to continue this conversation, but I have a very strict producer in my ear. I'm going to invite you both back because there's lots more I want to discuss on this issue, so please look out for my invitation. But for now, thank you so much, Idrissa Phil and
but
Ignatius
just quickly
Anon.
Before you go, yes. On Saturday, Yevgeny Prigozhin, who is the founder for Wagner, issued a statement to John Kirby, and essentially he was saying that, tell us exactly what we've done for you to designate us as a criminal organization. So that's something that we need to add.
Right, that was their response. Mm. Thank you for that. You're going to be in big trouble for adding that, Ignatius. But thank you to both gentlemen. Great to have you here with me. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, Nigerians are preparing to vote in a landmark election. After the break, we will look at what is at stake for the West African nation. Don't go away. We'll be right back. And you're with Straight Talk Africa. Welcome back. On February 25th, Nigerian voters head to the polls to choose their next president. This landmark election comes as Africa's most populous nation faces a worsening economic and security situation. Candidates are now crisscrossing the country, each one trying to make their case to voters. Our Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja for us, where he has been speaking to people about what matters most to them.
Haiti, it is now exactly 30 days to the elections that most Nigerians say will be the make or the break. There are 18 candidates in the race to become Nigeria's next president, but three men are standing tall. Among them is Peter Obi, a third-party candidate who rose to prominence in just a few months. He tells his supporters he will transform Nigeria's economy from, I quote, consumption to production, and help the country out of debt.
My most important expectation is for someone to... We want the person who is going to come into power to be selfless enough to put the country first. If we have a selfless leader, we have overcome 95% of our challenges.
Obi is already one top choice of four unofficial opinion polls ahead of the elections, but observers say the election is not that predictable. Bola Ahmed Tinubu is a former Lagos State governor contesting under the incumbent All Progressives Congress, APC. And a major opposition People's Democratic Party says former Vice President Atiku Abubakar is most suitable for the job. But these frontrunners have been separately indicted for alleged drugs trade, money laundering and tax evasion, raising questions about their election bid.
Our first challenge, our first problem is corruption. You know, because it's in the core of everything we do. It's in the industries, it's in the economy, it's in the banking sector, it's everywhere. So if we can tackle that and have honest leaders. I think that corruption factor is top priority when it comes to our choice of voting.
But the problem is more than systemic corruption. Nigeria is struggling to stem a wave of violence from Islamist militants, armed kidnappers, separatists, as well as communal clashes between farmers and herders. The country is also battling high inflation and unemployment. Observers say there's a big task ahead for whoever emerges as Nigeria's president. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And that is Timothy Obiezu there for us. Timothy, thank you. Now, to examine what is at stake in this election, I'm joined by Festus Okoye, who is the National Commissioner for Information with Nigeria's Independent National Electoral Commission. He joins me from Abuja. And Temi Ibirogba is an analyst with the Center for Strategic Studies, and she joins us via Skype from Lagos. Mr. Okoye and Temi, welcome to Straight Talk Africa. Temi, you've been on the show before, so nice to see you again as well. Mr. Okoye, thank you for your time. I'm going to start out with you. We've heard in Timothy's story there about the worrying security situation in Nigeria, including attacks on election officials. Now, your election chief, Mahmoud Yakubu, has said Nigeria will not postpone next month's election. Does that mean it's case closed? Is there any circumstance under which this vote could still be postponed?
Well, the remit of the Independent National Electoral Commission is to organize, undertake, and supervise election. And this commission released the timetable and schedule of activities for the 2023 general election. And in that particular timetable, we listed 14 critical items that must be accomplished. And out of those 14, we have already accomplished 11. So the dates fixed for the conduct of the national and state elections, that's the presidential and national assembly elections, as well as the governorship and state assembly elections, are fixed and firm, and we are proceeding with this election. The issue of rescheduling on the issue of postponement is not on the table.
Fair enough. Timmy, why is this being billed as such a tense, high-stake election? I mean, what is at stake for people in this vote?
Well, this is a super important election because of the issues of the economy, insecurity, and corruption. These issues are plaguing Nigeria's development. In the early 2000s, the federal government put out a strategic framework called Vision 2020, and that was to make Nigeria a strategic player in the global and political economy. But 2020 has come and passed, and we can see that a lot of discussions are had about Nigeria's potential, but the fact that as a country, it's not being reached. So that's why these issues are super important in this election.
Mr. Okoye, you've got about 10 million new voters registered as people have been scrambling to get the new permanent voter cards. We know the Independent National Electoral Commission's credibility has been in doubt in the past, even in recent weeks. What has been done on your commission's end to build trust among the electorate and ensure that the country will deliver a free, fair and credible election?
This commission has done a lot to make sure that this election is free, fair, transparent, verifiable, and inclusive. We've registered new voters. As of today, we have 93.4 million registered voters in Nigeria. And the collection of the permanent voters card is ongoing. And we are confident that majority of those who registered, or most of those who registered, we definitely collect their permanent voters cards on time for this election.
Timmy, Nigeria recently toughened its electoral laws. Outgoing President Muhammadu Buhari signed the electoral bill into law early last year after being very hesitant and reluctant to do so for years. So how far does that go towards raising the credibility of next month's election?
Well, you know, to analyze how far it will go, it's helpful to look at the 2015 and 2019 elections that led to this legislation. So during the 2015 election, INEC made major improvements to biometric technology to improve voter identification and reduce voter fraud. So this is when the PVCs and electronic card readers were introduced as part of this effort. But there are a lot of issues with card readers on election day. Biometrics could not be read, for example. Poll workers didn't know how to use the machines. And then during the 2019 election, INEC had the technical capability to transmit polling results electronically, but electoral results continued to be transmitted on paper forms because the legislation needed for the electronic transmission, was not in place, like you said. So there comes the Electoral Act of 2022, which allows for electronic voting and the transmission of election results, which are expected to improve the election transparency and also help to reduce vote rigging. It mandates that the recording of ballots at polling stations before their transmission to Abuja for real-time monitoring of electoral results by citizens, civil society organizations, watchdogs, which all in all will help with greater transparency.
And Mr. Okoye, you obviously have to be prepared for just about any event, any problems that might arise, problems that we have seen in the past. And I have a question here for you from one of our social media followers, Egbune Franklin. He says he's a journalist in Nigeria, and he asks, in case there is a network problem on the day of the election, is there a plan B with regards to the electronic transmission of results?
Yes, the plan B. What we have done as an electoral management body is that we have introduced the BVAS, the Bimodal Voter Accreditation System. Now, the BVAS for voter accreditation and authentication works offline. The only time it needs a network is when we are doing what we call result upload into our INEC result beam portal. Majority of our polling units are covered by the major network. And in the few places where we have blind spots, we have had series of meetings with the major networks in relation to those blind spots. And then we've been given the assurances and we've been given the technology to deal with those blind spots. So if there's any challenge with any of the areas, we have the capacity to overcome them.
And, you know, Mr. Okoye, of course, always it's the results end of elections that's almost always the most contentious. That's the part that can often lead to violence. There's a lot resting on that. Are you confident that those issues will be dealt in a manner that will not make people lose faith in the credibility of the vote counting and, of course, ultimately the results of the election?
Since 2020, this commission has conducted 105 off-cycle elections, and we transmitted the results of those off-cycle elections in real time, and there were no challenges. We have also used the BVAS to upload major results from Ekiti governorship election to Osun governorship election to Ondo and Anambra governorship elections. And we have more or less mastered the technology. On the 4th of February, this commission will also organize what we call mock accreditation using the BVAS. So we keep on improving with every election. And we are confident that with the technology we have, that we can transmit election results in real time without any challenge.
Timmy, we're moving on to the technological side of things here. There's so much buzz around candidates like Peter Obi's popularity. I see in the headlines about who has the largest social media following between Obi and his rivals, Atiku Abubakar and Asiwaju Bola Tinubu. Does a social media following necessarily translate into votes on election day? You know, I asked Peter Obi this question when I interviewed him late last year. He seems to think it will translate, or at least for him.
Well, the median age in Nigeria is 18, and since 2019, about 20 million Nigerians have turned 18 and are now eligible to vote. And then more than half of the 94 million registered voters in Nigeria are under the age of 30. So that's really showcasing the strong role youth can play in influencing this election. The number of eligible voters rose by 9 million, or around 11.3%, since the 2019 election. 40% of newly registered voters are students, and 75% of newly registered voters are youth. And this, juxtaposed with the 50% youth employment rate, clearly shows one of the key issues in this election that the candidates and the eventual winner need to address. And that really leads to Peter Obi's popularity. Youth want greater government responsiveness to citizen priorities, and they want enhanced transparency and accountability, which builds upon the demands of Nigerian youth during NSAS. NSAS represented not only a call to end police brutality and impunity, but also the erasure of bad governance in the country. Police brutality is just one of the many examples of the results of poor governance in Nigeria. So that's really why, you know, we've had such a large number of youth registering to vote. And, you know, to answer your question, yes and no, it could potentially translate into actual, it's translated to actual registration, but we'll see whether or not, you know, I don't want to predict who will win the election, but we'll actually have to wait and see if it actually translates to who actually wins the election. But it definitely translated in terms of the newly registered voters.
Mr. Okoye, very briefly, my final question to you. Nigeria has a two-round system for electing the president, and a candidate must have at least 25% of the vote in at least 24 of the 36 states to win, if I have that correctly. So can you tell us how long the vote counting process is expected to take, and what happens if no clear winner emerges in the immediate days after February 25th?
If no clear winner emerges, in other words, if no candidate secures the highest number of votes cast and then secures a quarter of the votes in two-thirds of all the states of the Federation and the Federal Capital Territory, Abuja, the Constitution obligates the Commission to conduct what it calls a second election between only two candidates out of the 18. One of the candidates must be the candidate that secured the highest number of votes in the election, and the second person will be the candidate that secured the majority of lawful votes in a majority of the states. In other words, the candidate that has the majority spread in the states of the Federation. What we do is that when we are preparing for the first election, we also prepare for a possible runoff or a possible second election. So we are preparing for a second election. If the condition does not exist for a second election, we destroy the ballot prepared for the second election. But we are hopeful that with the technology we have deployed, results will come in on time, and we'll be in a position to declare the results of the election quickly than we did in 2019.
Well, the rest of us will certainly be watching, and we wish the country of Nigeria a peaceful, a safe and free and fair election. We'll all be keeping an eye on it. Mr. Festus Okoye, I hope we can invite you back onto the show in the days after the election just for an update on how things are going. Mr. Festus Okoye and Temi Ibirogba, thank you both for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And that is our show for this week. Thank you so much to all of my guests and to you, our audience, for always watching and always listening. And a big thanks to all our affiliates airing Straight Talk Africa across the continent. We'll see you next time. Until then, go well. Goodbye.